Whether you're a nonprofit organization, an agency of government, a Fortune 100 corporation, or just someone who likes to keep up with family and friends on Facebook, online security is critically important, especially in a time when even very sophisticated and supposedly protected municipal computer networks have been hacked and held for ransom. On August 27th, an individual who is very knowledgeable about every aspect of cybersecurity spoke at length on the subject before the Economic Club of Florida. Coming up, that presentation by Manny Medina, Managing Partner at Medina Capital and CEO of Sixtera Technologies, a company that specializes in providing more secure computer systems. This program was recorded at the Florida State University Alumni Center in Tallahassee. Now, to get things started, here's Economic Club of Florida President Cindy O'Connell.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the 518th in our series of distinguished speaker programs. I'm Cindy O'Connell and I have the privilege of serving as your club president. Please silence your cell phones so that our program is uninterrupted. And now please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you so much. Just as a reminder, WFSU is audio recording this program for broadcast on 89.9 FM, which will air next Friday at 7 p.m. Our next scheduled program, and be sure to mark your calendars, for September 27th, as we welcome the president of merchandising at Fanatics.com, Mr. Jack Boyle. And be sure to check your tables for our schedule of speakers that are upcoming, or visit our website. I want to recognize a special group of individuals, our sustaining members. Without their support, their financial support, and commitment to this club each year, we would not be in as good a shape as we are. So could I have all the sustaining members please stand and be recognized? Now I'd like to introduce the head table. If you could hold your applause until I've introduced the entire table, I'd appreciate it. To my far right is Mr. Clay Ingram. Clay is a graduate of Florida State University, where he received his undergraduate degree in journal communication and was a member of the 1999 National Championship football team for all you Seminoles, so that's exciting. He served in the Florida House of Representatives from 2010 to 2018, representing his hometown of Pensacola and surrounding areas, before being appointed to the position of CEO of Volunteer Florida in January 2019. He worked prior to that as CEO of the Greater Pensacola Chamber of Commerce. We're so glad you're here, Clay. We'll go ahead and clap. To my right, Paul Lewis is the president and owner of PsyLynx Incorporated, a Tallahassee-based technology company founded in 1999 and specializing in enterprise automation. It's also a member of the Economic Club of Florida's board. Thank you, Paul, for joining us. To my immediate right is Mr. Ben Watkins, who is the director of the Division of Bond Finance for the state of Florida. Mr. Watkins is also the current chairman of the Economic Club and a sustaining member. Thank you, Mr. Watkins. Now, to my left, your right, is Mr. Ash Williams, who almost needs no introduction, but we'll do it anyway. Mr. Ash Williams is Executive Director and CIO of the Florida State Board of Administration, is responsible for managing approximately $195 billion in assets, including those of the Florida Retirement System. A man you need to know if you're retired. Prior to joining the SBA, Ash was a managing director of Fir Tree Partners and president and CEO of Schroeder Capital Management. Ash is a former chairman of this club. Thank you, Mr. Williams, for being here. We also have our distinguished guest, Manny Medina, who now I will ask Ash to come forward and introduce our guest.
Thank you, Cindy, and welcome all. Manny Medina, we are extraordinarily fortunate to have Manny with us today. He is emblematic of American entrepreneurship, leadership, and thought. Manny was born in Cuba in 1952, came here at age 13, and settled in Miami with his family, and enrolled in FAU, graduated in 1974 with a degree in accounting, practiced public accounting for a while, got into the real estate business, had a tremendously successful real estate business down in Miami, and from there founded a firm named Terramark, which was the same name his real estate company had, but this is an example of his intellectual capability and his entrepreneurial depth as well. So Terramark was a provider of managed IT infrastructure services. The clientele is Fortune 500 companies. That's not a business you wander into because you thought it would be a good idea. You've got to actually have something to get that clientele. And Manny had that something and had it in spades. So much so that that Terramark became a publicly traded company. It was on NASDAQ until April of 2011 when it was acquired by Verizon at an enterprise value of $2 billion, billion with a B. That is successful entrepreneurship. Under his leadership, Terramark distinguished itself in so many ways and built his reputation as a person with serious technology understanding and capability. After the sale of Terramark, Mr. Medina founded Medina Capital in 2012, a private equity firm investing in innovative companies in the data center, cybersecurity, data analytics, cloud infrastructure, and software as a service markets. He currently serves as its managing partner. He's also the chief executive of Sixtera Technologies, a global leader in data center infrastructure and cybersecurity solutions, and the founder, chairman, and chairman of the board of eMERGE Americas, the primary business-to-business technology event connecting the U.S., Latin America, and Europe. Now, that is an interesting one in that every March in Miami, to give you an idea of the magnitude of this event, 16,000 people were at the last one. Over 500 companies were involved. Manny's daughter, Melissa, showing that entrepreneurship and leadership have some genetic sustainability, is very involved in managing the eMERGE event, but it is quite the thing and a remarkable accomplishment. He has been recognized and had accolades from many business and community organizations for his leadership and community service. He's a frequent speaker on topics ranging from technology trends and global business and entrepreneurship, and has served either as a keynote speaker or a panelist at many large investor conferences and IT industry trade shows. I've seen him many times, and I'll tell you we're in for a treat today. His leadership in the IT industry and insightful analysis of market trends have resulted in appearances on NBC News, CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox Business, as well as interviews with global media outlets. Mr. Medina received his bachelor in accounting, as I said, from FAU, and started his career at Price Waterhouse. So Manny is a terrific Floridian, a great American, and a great example of why an immigration policy that has some flexibility makes some sense. This is a man who has created millions and millions of dollars of wealth for a large number of people, paid a lot of taxes, created a lot of jobs, done a lot of wonderful things. And if you paid attention to that business history of his, this is a person with a vision to look around corners, recognize needs, come up with solutions, and take them to market in scale in a way that's recognized through a profitable exit. Most importantly to me, Manny and I have been friends for nearly 40 years, and I'm delighted to welcome him here. Please join me.
Well, I promise you, after an introduction like that, it's downhill from here, so the best is over. I am just really humbled to be here today in front of you. It is a great honor. I really wasn't really that familiar with the Economic Club until Ash called me a few months ago and said, you know, would you like to come and talk about And I began looking, and I am just really humbled by the past membership, the present membership. Thank you, Cindy. Thank you for everybody that I've met today. I am really truly honored to be here in front of you. I'm going to also, hopefully today, scare you a little bit in a good way, because I really hope if I've done my job at the end of this presentation, if whatever institution, whether you personally or if you belong to an institution, you leave here and go ask a few questions of your people about what's happening with your infrastructure and the security of your infrastructure. Because we really, truly are living in some pretty dangerous times. And that's what my presentation is about today. Well, it's called the cyber crisis, and this is something that unfortunately affects all of you. And I start out by directing you, the board is there, but directing you to one of my favorite quotes from Leon Trotsky. It says, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you, right? You may not be interested in cybersecurity, but it's interested in you. That basically, because it does not at all discriminate. It basically picks on everybody everywhere that we are today. We are at the cusp of the fourth industrial revolution. This is a revolution like we've never seen before because of the speed of the change, the vast majority of changes that are happening at speeds that is almost comprehensible to the human mind. Things like artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, robotics, driverless cars, everything, the advent of Internet of Things, 5G being deployed, all of this is happening at the cusp of this fourth industrial revolution. And it's happening at a pace that is very difficult for all of us to comprehend and basically accept that there's no turning back. No matter where you are, you're going to be affected by this fourth industrial revolution, even if you're in the middle of a woods and growing pine trees, right? So basically, there's something that drives this industrial revolution, and that is a simple word: data. It's all about data today. Data is a great commodity; it's very valuable, very dangerous, and that's what drives this fourth industrial revolution. I put some numbers up there. It's kind of difficult to comprehend the scope of this. So for example, you say the data sphere is 175 zettabytes. Now what's a zettabyte, right? So I was thinking of what's the statistic to best put it into reality. Everybody watches HDTV videos, right? I mean, it's a high quality. You know, that's the one that is the data hog because it really requires a lot of storage, et cetera. One zettabyte, just one zettabyte, is 36 million years of continuous HDTV video, just to put that into perspective, right? So think about that in the context of the vast amount of data that is floating around the world. With the advent of 5G, the Internet of Things is already a reality, but it will be so commonplace with 22 billion, depending who you speak to, 22 billion devices, billions of humans connecting to machines, machines connecting to machines and to each other. This Internet of Things is one of the most exciting, at the same time, is one of the most dangerous parts. Just to put it into perspective, this cross trade of data around the world represents $11 trillion to our own economy, basically. So that's the vast amount of it, and it's all based on those four syllables, D-A-T-A. Data, right? And that data is now something that everybody's drinking from a gigantic fire hose. So I'm just giving you this background because today, in order for you to deal with that, you gotta have scale. These businesses are cross country. You're scaling at a volume that it was inconceivable for you to be able to do just a few short years ago. Speed. Everything today is about speed, right? Basically, forget about instant trading. Basically, today everything's, think about with the advent of 5G, it is phenomenal what's gonna happen, right? I mean, for me to do this, raise my hand, it takes 200 milliseconds from the moment that I tell my brain, raise my left hand for me doing it. 5G will do this in 5 milliseconds. Which is unheard of. It's almost difficult to comprehend. Why? Because when you're dealing with driverless cars, when you're dealing, all this computational needs to be done in real time, right at the moment. Is that a person? Do I left, turn right, or turn right? So speed drives this revolution, scale, speed. And then third, which is really what I'm gonna spend my time talking to you about today, is security, right? And security, unfortunately, is the rock where this fourth industrial revolution will flounder, because what is happening is that we have not been prepared for it. And today, we really and truly are living on an epidemic, right? And this is really what I'm here to talk to you about today. As CIOs, not like Ash, CIOs of money, but chief information officers and chief information security officers, as these companies transform themselves, they need to digitize their entire infrastructure in order for them to be able to cope or bear or really be part of this fourth industrial revolution. And that digitization of your environment is irreversible. You have to do it. You cannot do this the old way. So it's happening. As a matter of fact, one of the most prestigious analysts in our industry is a company called Gartner. You may have heard of it. They do an annual CIO survey about what is happening with their IT infrastructure environment. As of last year, 49% said they're in the process of totally transforming their entire IT infrastructure to digitizing their entire IT infrastructure. As a matter of fact, a third of them are already post-digitization and basically are running their business totally digitized. What does that actually mean? It means that you have to do drastic changes to your infrastructure to go from a legacy system to a digitized infrastructure that we'll talk a little bit more about today. But it's pretty traumatic when you do that undertaking. And today I'm going to tell you a little story because I think it brings it to reality of one of these very eager young CEOs who digitized his company and basically and what happens to him. So basically, this CEO, you know, he's young and upcoming. He took his company public about a year and a half ago. He's now Friday is his board meeting. He's presenting to his board. He's going to have the quarterly conference call. Having run a publicly traded company, I assure you that quarterly conference call, as many of you I'm sure know, you know, it's a moment that you don't cherish, unless you really have some very good news. Then you can't wait for it to happen, because you just, you know, when you have bad news, you get ostracized. When you get good news, it really feels good. So the feeling when you have good news is of anticipation. So he knew that he was going to be in for a great call, right? His revenues were skyrocketing, right? His profits were up. The stock was soaring. The analysts were ecstatic. They loved him. He had significantly dropped his costs by digitizing the company, and therefore, so he was very, very proud that the entire infrastructure costs have gone down significantly, to the point that he bragged to all his folks that even his coffee machine was now part of the digital infrastructure. All he had to do was take his iPhone, press, and his coffee's brewed by the time he got there. Never had to order coffee again. The coffee machine was automatic. It was self-ordered coffee. He was so proud of all this stuff, right? As he looked to the conference call on Monday. Sunday comes about, he shoots the best 18 holes he's ever shot in his entire life. Man, I am it. I am really, really, really part of this in a way that I know that I'm gonna kick butt, basically. And he nailed it. He absolutely nailed it. Monday morning comes about, of course, he's in the office by 6 a.m. He couldn't wait to have his conference call. He goes to press his coffee machine, and this is what he sees, right there. And then he thinks, at the very beginning, he thinks it's a joke. This is true, by the way. I'm not making this up. He thinks it's a joke. And he took some jokes, he looks, it's his iPhone. It's all part of the same network now, right? His iPhone, the same, it's called. He's going to try to call. There's no calling because it's all part of the IP phone, right? So he runs, basically, in a panic to his laptop in his office, flips it, and this is what he says. We're in complete control. His conference call is in 3 hours. He's trying to get a hold of his people. Can't call, can't email, can't text because he's now paralyzed. He's been attacked by ransomware. And at that point, within a half hour, he gets an open communication to his own personal phone and says, we want $10 million, right, in bitcoins, and we want to pay at this address at this point. What do you do? You know, it kind of reminds me a little bit like the Mike Tyson story. Everybody has a plan until it gets hit in the mouth. Well, this is what happens. When you get hit like this, I am telling you because I have lived it personally. My team cannot keep up with what is happening day in and day out. With this. So eventually, it comes to the question, what do you do? All of a sudden, his world has crumbled. in a way that he never ever imagined. The same way that basically, as you see Ginni Romney, the CEO of IBM, saying that this is an existential threat, the greatest threat for every company in the world. Not just for companies, by the way. It's for every educational institution, for every government agency, right? For every hospital, right? For you individually. These are really and truly existential threats that are happening today, that are wreaking havoc in a way that we have not seen. And we're not going to stop seeing, unfortunately, because there's no real solution. And I'll get a little bit more into the things you can do about that in a way. And it's now to the point that this epidemic, I'm sure you're mostly familiar with some of these breaches, but Equifax, you know, 150 million people, right, basically. Forget about the billions of dollars of the aftermath of the company, their reputation, everything that has happened. It caused so much wreck. Marriott, 500 million customers of Marriott. I assure you that the vast majority of you here in this room, your personal information is in the dark web. No question about it. It's been stolen from somewhere, right? Because what happens, and the reason I focus on this particular breaches, these big breaches, is because it's so massive. South Korea is the most connected country. 95% of the population of South Korea has been compromised. They're now talking about changing their 10-digit ID number. Think about us changing our social security number into a new number. Can you imagine that? And that is really to the point that it's gotten today, right? So these breaches, when you put it together, Capital One, this just happened very recently, right? Hundreds of millions, Anthem, hundreds of millions of so these breaches will continue to go on and then basically get to a point where what do we do about you personally, right? Because that's what I'm saying, it's affecting you, whether you're interested or not, it's affecting you. One of the real incredible epidemics is ransomware. I don't know if any of you saw 60 Minutes this last Sunday, but 60 Minutes had a whole segment nationally on ransomware and what is happening to all this. Some of these examples here, Baltimore. Baltimore had a $76,000 ransomware ask in bitcoins. They refused to pay. By now, they're up to $20 million trying to recover the data because they didn't pay, right? Now, on the other hand, basically, Atlanta, the same thing. They refused to pay. They're now, forget about 2.6, I was just seeing yesterday. They're in the tens of millions of dollars. And they still, now what happens? Imagine a city that is being hit, and all of a sudden you can't get access to the court system, you can't get access to your water bills, you can't get access to traffic tickets, you can't get access to emergency systems sometimes. What do? You're paralyzed, right? Basically, and this is all being done in a very systematic way. Right here in Tallahassee, $500,000 diverted in payroll, right here in this city. This is in May of this year. I don't know if all of you remember doing that. Lake City just happened, $460,000 ransomware. Key Biscayne, Stewart, Riviera Beach. It's an epidemic over and over. This is today's Miami Herald. I just brought it with me because it's today's Herald. Expect more Florida cities to be hacked. Why are cities being hacked? Because they're easy pickings. They basically, in the mayor and the commissioners or the councilmen have so many priorities and they don't think about this. They don't think that this is a priority. So their IT infrastructure is very antiquated and they never take money aside to go in and invest in this. So they're easy targets. And they basically are the easiest picking that there is. And of course the perpetrators know this. Can't catch them because this is all being done from foreign countries that we have no access, we can't extradite them. We're really fighting a very, very, very losing battle, right? In a way that we're losing the battle, basically, today. And it's really, really scary, as you saw in that in that little story that I told you about this anonymous CEO of this publicly traded company, right? And just to put some perspective in it, annual cyber crime in a couple of years will be more than actually the illicit drug trade. That's saying a lot. The problem is that the collateral damage of the cyber crime is much bigger than the drug trade, because the drug trade, notwithstanding all the terrible things that it does, and I'm not condoning it, basically, but at the end of the day, typically if you're putting drugs into your body, you're harming yourself, you typically have a lane of people that are killing each other. You typically, you know, of course, you have corruption, you have money, but it's somewhat contained. you're not going to bring down the electrical grid. You're not going to bring down hospitals. If you saw in 2017, there was a cyber attack called NotPetya, and it's the first time that you could actually see the physical harm to individuals. The NIH, or the National Institute of Health in England, was hacked in the middle of an operation. If today you're getting an open heart surgery or any complicated operation in your hospital, and that hospital gets whacked, your chances of dying are going to be very high, because they have access to nothing else. So in that particular case, people actually died, and you could see people in the stretchers being pulled out because the doctors could not continue on with the operation at this particular time. So this collateral damage of cyber is much bigger than the actual drug trade itself. And what is happening right now, if you take a look at Silas Vance, the state attorney of the state of New York, he said that today, over 25% of his felonies are cyber-related. And he was saying why. Because if you are, it's very relatively simple, not that I'm going to give you a lecture on it today, but relatively simple for you to become a cyber criminal. It takes very little, you don't even have to be an expert at all, basically, because you can buy the software, you can rent it, do it as a joint venture with a software provider, and all you need to do is just a physical body with a little bit of IQ. But basically, he was saying that the reason is that if you go rob a liquor store with a gun, you get caught, you're going to get 10, 15 years. You get caught on a cyber crime, you're going to get a slap on the wrist, basically. Now, it's changing. So the entire damage of the cyber is phenomenally more impactful than the illicit drug trade in the entire world, which is a big statement to say, right? In global ransomware, now, typically they don't do big amounts, meaning big, where they don't want to, because they want you to pay. So $11.5 billion this year, these are only the ones that we know, because a lot of people don't report it. They're too embarrassed, they don't want to do it, you know, et cetera. So basically, and then what happens now, this is from a business opportunity point of view, which is really why we are so also involved in this business now, and pretty much so focused on the cyber business, is it's $1 trillion of global spending on cyber defense a year. That's a lot of money, basically, you know, trying to protect yourself against all this. One of the questions that I'm always asked is why? Why can we not stop this? Why is it so difficult? I'm talking from an enterprise point of view, or from a government, or from an institutional point of view. And there's a very basic reason why. And that's kind of a diagram there. It's a little bit busy. But basically what happens is, fundamentally, IT infrastructure changed at a very drastic speed, and security stayed in the 80s, basically. So if you think about our IT infrastructure today, life used to be very simple, right? You would come to your office, no matter where you were, your office, you log in, you turn on your computer. Your computer was tethered to your servers, which were down in the basement somewhere, or your own data center. And then you come in, you did your work. At the end of the day, you turn off your computer, and you went home. And that's the way it was, right? Through the 80s, the 90s, as all of this happened. So what happened was that security basically was done by creating a perimeter around where your infrastructure was. So think about the moat around the castle. You say, well, if I create this perimeter, nobody's going to get in. And that's fundamentally a perimeter-based hardware. So companies such as Cisco, Juniper, et cetera, will sell you all this hardware, and this is where you create it. You put the firewalls in there, and basically, and that was a fundamental basic. Now, what happened was that that IT infrastructure and that perimeter doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. That perimeter is gone. You basically, the advent of little things like mobility that didn't exist then, your infrastructure is now in multiple places. If you're an enterprise, you're using Office 365, you're using AWS, Azure, Google, you have your own hybrid infrastructure that is composed of your own private cloud. You have a part of the equipment in a co-location facility, part of equipment still in your old data center, so that hybrid infrastructure, how do you put a perimeter around it? You can't put a perimeter around it. But fundamentally, 90% of enterprises in government is, in enterprise now probably in the 80s, but of government is still using the same perimeter base, where you basically come in and do this. And it is like definition of insanity. Keep doing the same thing and expect different results, right? So that's what happened. There was a disconnect. In the meantime, security stayed there. Fundamentally, notwithstanding the fact of all the changes and all the billions of dollars that have been spent, the vast majority of security today is still IP address to IP address. Can this IP address connect with this IP address? That's what a firewall does. And the answer is binary, yes or no. And that, I'm telling you, in today's world does not work. It's not like yes or no. The answer is really maybe, as you'll see in a second. So what happens is it's a disconnect between the security of that infrastructure that changed so vastly, at the same time that you're drinking from the gigantic fire hose of data, you're trying to protect that data when it's static, when it's in motion, and it doesn't work. It's just basically been outdated. I have a friend who's in the industry who says that if you take an IT professional from 20 years ago, and you take a security professional, a cybersecurity professional from 20 years ago, and if they were both in a cave and you bring them out, and the IT guy is going to say, what is this? What is this virtualization? You know, what is cloud? You know, what is mobility? You know, what is all this stuff? I don't understand this. The security guy right away says, oh, yeah, you know, IP to IP, firewall. Nothing has changed, right? So, and the reason I emphasize this, because really now there's solutions to it. So what happens now? So what do you do? Well, right now there are new ways. You'll be reading a lot about what is called a zero trust model that basically reinvents security for today's world. It reinvents security for a hybrid model, for this multi-cloud, multi-infrastructure model where you can actually then protect. It moves beyond the outdated perimeter that I've just finished telling you that does not work anymore. It defaults trust, meaning that it leads to attacks from within the network, right? So anybody gets into the network, you avoid by limiting the access of that individual within the network. And then basically it helps you be dynamic, make security more like the cloud. The cloud is self-provisioning. It grows by itself. Security should be exactly the same, not waiting and call for another piece of hardware that you put in. So the zero trust model is the only way where you can begin to fight this epidemic that we have today internally. Most of you in this room right here, wherever your institution is, you're probably still connected through a VPN. I promise you, by now, a Gartner itself says in a couple of years, 70% won't. That virtual private network, it's actually in the security business, it's called a very porous network, because anybody can get into it. And fundamentally, that will actually be going out the way of the dodo as it changes. What does that mean? And how do you actually do it, right? So how do you implement this? The first thing that you do is you reduce your attack surface. Today, typically when you connect through a VPN to your network, you go in and you're given access to your entire network. Basically, that should definitely not be the case, because you have this attack surface then that you can move into, this entire attack surface, because your entire network, you come in, you hear you authenticate, whether you even use multi-factor, you put your password, you know, maybe get a text back, and you're into the network. Once you're into the network, and sometimes perpetrators are into the network for years before even people know that it's there, right? The first thing that you need to do, and I know this may sound a little bit technical, but you need to reduce that attack of the network. The way you reduce that attack is by giving access to people, to users, for things that only they need to use. In other words, if you're working in payroll, there's no reason why you need to look at the patents that the company has stored or the company jewels. So reducing that attack surface through this new technology that exists today is number one. The narrower your attack surface is, the more difficult you make it to be able to get them to hack into your environment today. Number two, instead of making this IP-centric, make it identity-centric. In other words, if you think about the answer, can this IP address connect to this IP address, the answer is not yes or no binary, it's maybe. What does that mean? It depends on the circumstances. Besides, it depends on many factors, context of that given moment. Ash Williams, Ash is the CIO of SBA. He's the head, he gets to his office, he logs on, there's 28 or 29 factors that are immediately, besides his identity, besides his password, and besides his multi-factor authentication, what time of day is it, what network is he logging in from, you know, is the machine being patched, etc. So all that, okay, it's Ash, let's give him access. Now Ash decides to take his iPad and go down to Starbucks to get some coffee. Now he gets his iPad and he opens up, he wants to do some workbook. Based on that context, his vulnerability is significantly higher. Why? He's now logging in a public or semi-public Wi-Fi network, right? That is very, very, very easy to target. So maybe based on that context, Ash should only get access to a certain amount of applications. And that is done all dynamically, right? It doesn't. There's no pain to Ash. Basically, it all happens dynamically. Now he decides to go to China because he has to go to an investor conference in China. Now he logs in. Based on that context, he may only have access to the travel desk, right? So that's basically, you make that identity-centric versus IP-centric. The answer is not yes or no, the answer is maybe. And this is all done dynamically, no different than the cloud itself. And then lastly, you have to have enough ability for you to be able to detect what's in your network. What happens today is that a lot of these folks are, again, drinking from a fire hose. You get all these alarms, but then you don't get to analyze the alarm until 6 months later. It's only when the money has been already been spent in Belarus. So what happens now is you have to have enough, and this, with the advent of artificial intelligence, it's helping a lot for you to be able to consume and digest all of this at a time that is basically real time. So you can able to act without having to waste time and let the perpetrator get away from you. Hopefully, it hasn't been too boring. I don't want to be presumptuous, and you know, and again, I've said a lot of things, and I know this is not something you're getting up in the morning thinking about, and you're not getting up in the morning thinking about it until it happens to you or to your organization, I promise you, and then you'll be thinking about it a lot, and you know, and I hate to, because I'm a very positive person. So the message here is today is, if I've accomplished you going back to your institutions and say, you know, I had this crazy guy talking about all this stuff today, what do we do? And where is our data? And how long does it really take to recover? And how do I live without recovering? You know, the example that I always use also is when I started in I started in this business in the mid-90s. And in the early 2000s, we built a very fortified data center in Miami called the Network Access Point of the Americas, which is like a gigantic fort. If any of you have seen it in downtown Miami, it has three major big domes in front of it. And what happened was that the internet really didn't become dependent on the internet until the late 90s and early 2000s. But we had not had a hurricane since Andrew in 1992. In 2005, we had first Katrina and then Wilma. Wilma wasn't a major hurricane, but it knocked down power for 2 weeks. We have pictures in the lore of our companies that people with their servers in the back of their trucks with cash saying, connect me, because you can't live without it. That entire advancement is now translated into the vulnerability of you having your data in a way that has to be protected. So I apologize if it got a little bit complicated, but I hope you understand. And if I accomplish that, I've done my job of coming to see you. Again, thank you for having me here, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Bitcoin seems to be the enabler for the ransomware. Why can't we just stop Bitcoin? Then nobody can pick up the money.
Yeah, so it's a very good question, actually. So blockchain, by definition, it's very, very difficult, because blockchain, when you have a blockchain composed of hundreds of thousands of users, right, and that's really what, as you mine these bitcoins, and it's a whole different conversation, it's almost impossible for you to trace it. And the effort of you for a law enforcement agency to go across cross borders in countries that have no law, very little law, or don't care about this, is almost impossible for you to do. That's why it becomes anonymous. If it's, like for example, if you were to kidnap the President of the United States and get paid in bitcoins, I assure you that it will be traced, right? But the effort of, well, some people may be happy and not trace it, but anyways, but if maybe a bad example. So basically, but it's very, very, the effort of you being able to go and trace the miners that are doing this through the entire blockchain composed of hundreds of thousands of people is almost impossible. Literally almost impossible. No. Technically capable, almost impossible because of the amount of resources that you would have to use. But it's a very good question. Yes?
I have heard that a quantum computer will make all the security a moot point. Everything's secure to that point will be unsecure.
Yeah, I mean, the point of quantum computing being able to break encryption keys, which is what you're referring to, encryption keys not being valid, is something that has been talked about for a long time. I think we're still years away from quantum computing being able to be utilized, either pro or con. I think that encryption keys still work, will be working for many, many years to come. There are some that are substantially more sophisticated than others. And if I were a mayor in a city, or if I was a director of a hospital, or if I was the head of a university, I wouldn't be waiting for quantum computing if I got a ransomware attack to decode the encryption key that they're asking me to pay, $100,000 for. But eventually, quantum computing will change the equation, no different than virtualization changed it, but we're just still years away from there.
This was a fascinating presentation. Thank you very much for doing this.
No, my pleasure.
One question I've had for a long time is, at the fundamental level, the chips that we use, that are the seed of every phone, etc., is made offshore. How do we know that the software that's on that chip 100% secure?
Wow, this is a really, really good question. And the reason I'm smiling is because I'm very seldom asked that question. And it's probably one of the most critical questions, is how do you know the integrity of that chip and where that chip resides, right? So firmware, which is what you're referring to, software sits on top of that. So firmware is a very big danger. But it's somewhat, supply chains, as the chips are created, that depending where they're created, this is why when you deal with the federal government, which is one of our biggest customers, having a totally domestic created supply chain is a lot easier. Because at any point in that supply chain where the weakness exists, yes, you could have a vulnerability that is actually hidden and not open until years later, right? And that's the whole thing. That's why they're so afraid of Huawei. Besides the commercial aspect of it, and this is a very big vulnerability. So there are now new companies that are going in and certifying. All of this is very expensive, right? So they're coming in, and you come in, and you can certify that your firmware is actually safe, and that you don't have any vulnerabilities, because they're just a lot more difficult. Now, they're a lot more difficult to implement, because you have to have collusion in order for you to do that. You have to have collusion between the manufacturer of the chip and the people doing it. Software bugs are a lot easier. You don't need collusion. All you need is somebody. And by the way, just so you don't feel bad, when you get all these phishing emails today have become extremely well targeted. If they want you, you're going to open it, because your social profile, your social media, et cetera. But today, when we do tests for customers all the time, and basically, typically it's about 40 or 50%, and this is not even targeted to Cindy specifically. This is just more broad, and you get the reply. So the biggest weakness, by the way, in cyber, we have a motto, and the motto is we don't like people, right? Because the biggest weakness is the human. Right, at the end of the day, the human is the one that's going to make that error, and he's going to come in and say, yep, you know what, I do want that 10% discount. Let me click here. You know what? Hey, that looks like a really pretty picture. I don't really look at porn, but that looks kind of click. Let me just click on this, let me click on this site. And this happens over and over again, and it's not going to stop. So you can assume that you're going to get infected, right? So anyways, yeah. Sorry, I think. Manny, please.
Manny, thank you. We all need to be reminded of this. And we had a lecture this past year, I think, that talked about security, so we can't be reminded enough. Thank you. I have a quick question. I've followed some of these ransoms of the cities. What happens? They don't pay. I mean, it's just like ransom.
It is chaos.
They don't pay, but now what? What's wrong?
It is chaotic. Atlanta still doesn't have all his data back. And it happened a year and a half ago.
So for everyone here, like myself, I have an office, have patients. If you can believe that in my business, which I deal with, I have cannabis patients.
Right, right.
I have no electronic charge for the exact reason you're talking. There is no 100% way to secure anything. So I have all physical charts. It's hard to believe. I have everything typed.
No.
It's all physical. And the reason is because there's no way to...
Well, I think the key here is, Yes, if you say to me, I want you to give me a guarantee 100%, if you're connected to the internet, it doesn't exist, basically. Unless you go archaic, you know, unless you go analog, basically there was a breach in a dam in New York, and they breached it, the Iranians breached it as a prelude to a bigger breach that they were trying to do. R. Ciso was the former head of cyber for the FBI in New York. He had 450 agents under him, so he's been part of all these breaches. And so the reason why they didn't succeed is because half of the operation was still analog. Had it been digital, he would have succeeded. So, but having said all that, I'll tell you the example that I always use. If you're going into a neighborhood, and you know, and you're going to go into a house that has two Rottweilers that are attack trained, it has a door that has significant alarm, it has all the security systems, you know, etc., and you're a thief, and the door next door has open door, you know, with a little bunny rabbit and saying, welcome, where are you going to go? Because it's not worth it for you. Because remember, all these people are doing it for money. Now, there's a caveat right now that I'll address in a second. The caveat is you're doing it for money, right? You're going to get paid. This is why when people in the ransomware, they negotiate. And you negotiate from 50,000 down to 10,000 because at the end of the day, this mayor on the 60 Minutes program on Sunday, he says, you know, we're a little city in Alabama. You know, we can't afford to pay $55,000. We ended up paying $8,000. But at the end of the day, they all want, they're doing it for the money. Except what happens in these massive state-sponsored attacks, like what happened with NotPetya, and all this, that it was disguised as a ransom attack, but you couldn't pay. It was really just to do damage, right? And to do damage. And that really started with Sony Pictures and the North Korean and that famous picture, that they go into an environment just to destroy the environment and to do damage, right? It's substantially more easy, by the way, to do damage in an environment than to extract value from that environment, because then you get a much higher chance of getting caught, which are still very small anyways. But if you go in to do damage, it's very simple. All you need to do is get in. And then there's all kinds of bugs that you can put in to destroy your data. And that is really, and this is a trend that we're seeing more. You don't see so much publication on it because people, again, we deal a lot with the federal government because you don't want to scare people. But it really is scary. If they come to your environment and if they eventually decide to pay, not to pay, etc., and all they do is destroy, it's very difficult to prevent.
So pay ransom, have backup data, and there's...
Well, look, I'm telling you something. Don't pay ransom because a lot of the people that pay ransom cannot even... Because there's so many amateurs today. It is very, very simple. If you go to the dark web, which, by the way, is not so dark. If you want to today, just Google. Google personal identities. Google, I want to buy social security numbers. I want to buy healthcare numbers. You'll see. There's a myriad, thousands of websites in the so-called dark web, in the underbelly of the internet, basically. But what happens today is in ransomware, which is so simple, you can go in, and there is software sites that you can get from Ukraine or from, you know, any one of these countries, it could be Iran or whatever, where you do, they take a piece of your cut. You don't have to buy anything. All you need to do is just have a broadband connection and a laptop. And then they download the software for you as a rental. You don't pay for it. And then when you get a ransom, you give them a cut. It is so simple today. Now you say to your question back there, why don't we stop it? It's like pushing back the ocean. Right? Why don't we stop illicit drugs? You can't, basically. So this is really, it's really, really scary because if you do that, now there's this whole epidemic that is happening where if you have a mind of being a thief or something, it is the easiest way for you to make money with the lowest penalty today. That's really the equation. And when you have a situation like that, what's going to happen? A lot more people are going to be able to do it. God forgive us if, in fact, there's a recession. So, please.
Thank you. Now that I've heard you, I'm probably going to attempt to read the security policies that the financial institutions send out.
Right.
I've never even tried to read them.
Right.
So do I need to look for the word zero? What
would zero trust. No,
is that what I need to look for? Because I probably won't understand.
No, you so look. Let me put you at ease in that aspect of it. If you're dealing with a major financial institutions. If you're dealing, notwithstanding the fact that Capital One got breached, and that was a really an inside job, right? Because it was a former employee that had access to AWS and whatever, but nevertheless, I assure you that the major financial institutions are safe, right? Because they spend a lot of money. And there's no way you can become an expert. And those financial policies is no different than you agreeing to everything else that you do on the web, right? You go in and you go to any site and it says, click here, you accept. Are you going to go out and read 30 pages of that? No, don't do that. So, I mean, if I were dealing, you know, with a less sophisticated institution, I'd just be more careful, right? You know, basically just be more aware of you know, we have 650 banks as customers, basically, and, you know, there's a lot the banks do today because they want to avoid the reputational risk besides the money itself. So I wouldn't be, you know, look, I think the whole thing here is that you just need to be more aware, even for you personally. Personally, go get LifeLock. It's only $100 a year. I don't have anything to do with LifeLock. Or get another one of the company. But get yourself monitored. The first thing they'll do is, yeah, you are in the dark web, and they'll do it. And it's very simple, right? Every time they say, you know, you can get your credit frozen just by the click of a mouse or by a phone call. So just do things. Do multi-factor authentication. Just don't log in to your Yahoo or your Google email. You know, make sure you get back. Just little things that are perhaps a tiny bit inconvenient, but make it a lot more difficult for you to become a target of this epidemic that, unfortunately, we're going to be living with way after all of us are gone. And now, from a positive point of view, from a business perspective, you know, it's a... It's a very good business, you know, today. You know, it's what can I tell you? So
I think I can be heard. I'm Michelle Rowe with Best Blended, and I just wanted you to speak a little bit to the electric grid and how vulnerable you perceive that we are with the electric.
Yeah, so again, the electric grid, is it vulnerable in the sense that I go to sleep worrying about it at night? No. Is it because basically a lot has been done to it? But it really depends. There's a lot of hidden weapons today. Something that happened when the Israelis and the United States, they created this very powerful bug called Stuxnet. And when the Iranians were lighting up their nuclear capabilities, they infected with offensive weapons the Iranians' centrifuges to the point that brought the whole thing down. Crazy, right? And it was, now this is all public knowledge. You can read it in all over the place. That unleashed something that hadn't happened before, and that is offensive. So offensively, we have significant amount of weapons, but so do they. So there's a lot of weapons that are dormant, that are sleeping, that you don't even know they're there, and we have them, they have them. And it's something that eventually, hopefully, you know, I don't know how this will eventually be avoided, because for me it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when you're going to have one of this. We haven't had the cyber 9/11, unfortunately. I continue by saying yet, right? Because I think the capabilities are there, and we're also vulnerable. So the electrical grid, I mean, it's tough for you to be able to say, I'm going to bring the entire Northeast United States, you know, down. But is it possible? Yes, absolutely possible. There are perhaps other targets that are significantly more easier, like water, for example. You know, what is happening now with contamination of water, a lot of this is all digital, right? So basically, how much you put in, how much you don't put in. There are some great demonstrations that you see today when you talk about the Internet of Things, when you see about, I mean, we used to do that for fun, which is an insulin pump. My team, I have a great team of hackers, those guys and girls, by the way, some girls, you know, you just put him behind the door, you throw some raw meat at him, you know, let him come out every now and then for said, because there's a very, very, very thin difference. You know, I had a very good friend of mine who spent his whole career in the DA. He says the difference between a drug dealer and a drug agent is razor thin. They're both about the same, and the same thing happens here, right? So basically, and basically, with all this incredible hacking today that is going on, with this power that they have, they really enjoy showing each other off, right, in what they're able to do. So we'll see. Yeah.
Well, I know you all join me in thanking Manny Mandina for being here today.
Thank you.
Manny, it's this is a scary part of the brave new frontier, but I'm happy you're on our side.
Oh, thank you very much.
And as a token of our appreciation, I'd like to give you this eagle by Sandy Proctor, one of our local artists.
Thank you very much
for sharing your expertise and knowledge with us.
I'll display it with great pride. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we stand adjourned.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting of August 27, 2019. The featured speaker was cybersecurity expert Manny Medina. This program was recorded at the Florida State University Alumni Center in Tallahassee. Join us again next time for another Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting from WFSU Public Media.